Welcome to the reading of the Quad City Times for Friday, March 8th. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Your readers today are Jim Hoffman, and my name is Rachel Mithelman. And here is Jim with our first story.
And starting with some local news here, this comes from East Moline, written by Grace Kennicott of the Quad City Times. Mayor, city, a vibrant community. Freeman delivers annual State of the City address. East Moline hopes to continue the momentum and achieve great things for years to come, the mayor says. Mayor Reggie Freeman delivered the annual State of the City address Thursday, emphasizing the future growth of the city and how far they have come over the past year. Freeman highlighted large projects that the city hopes will spur more economic growth. These projects, he said, couldn't be done without the work of partners and city officials. East Moline is not just a city, it's a vibrant community of dedicated individuals working tirelessly to build a better tomorrow, he said. Let us remember that progress is not achieved alone, but through collaboration, innovation, and shared vision for a brighter future. The biggest project for East Moline is connecting the Bend, the Rust Belt, and 15th Avenue downtown. In 2022, the city was awarded nearly $24 million in federal infrastructure funding through a RAISE grant to help with downtown revitalization. One of the goals with the project is to create a more walkable and bike-friendly downtown. As a public input meeting in February, city engineer Tim Kramler said the project has three primary goals: improve connectivity and connection through infrastructure improvements, placemaking and signage, continue to support economic development, and facilitate safe pedestrian and bicycle travel between the riverfront and residential areas. The project is broken into three phases, with the first phase focusing on the Bend, second phase on the Rust Belt, and the last phase extending the 15th Avenue District to the Rust Belt and Bend. The city's goal is to finish the last phase in 2027. Freeman also highlighted priorities and goals council has established. Five priorities and goals established by council are undertaking a comprehensive review of city revenues, developing a five-year staffing plan, creating a community development department, creating a rental housing code, an inspection program, and creating communications plans. This year, the city has budgeted for a neighborhood stabilization fund to help with land acquisition, demolition, and stabilization of problem properties, Freeman said. According to the city's fiscal year 2024 budget, it is being funded with $300,000. Freeman also said they are working with the Quad City Land Bank Authority to identify and manage problem properties, exploring the adoption of new policies and ordinances for abandoned and vacant buildings, and creating a rental housing code and inspection program. Council also passed a resolution recently to undertake facilities master planning for water and wastewater facilities that are nearly 70 years old or older, Freeman said. Such planning will tell us about needed upgrades to improve operations. Public safety is receiving $1.5 million in new equipment, Freeman said, after being awarded a grant from the Illinois Department of Commerce and Economic Opportunity, according to the slides Freeman used. The grant will help cover the cost of a new fire engine, drone, tasers, K-9 program, radar units for squared cars, and more. The city also is proposing a business development district to attract new investment growth and business development. A program that allows the city to apply for additional sales tax in a specific area to increase local services, amenities, employment opportunities, and sales and property taxes. The city also is exploring expanding the Quad Cities Enterprise Zone to cover older and distressed neighborhoods to help reduce rehab costs and a tax increment finance, or TIF, district. Other achievements. Freeman said 2,000 such as plans for a new car wash, coffee shops, and other retail. If you get money, you want to invest. Invest in car washes and drive up coffee shops because they are going everywhere. Getting a wide laugh from the room. Residential development at the quarter also has reached the third phase in which duplexes are being sold. Freeman said over this past 15 months, there have been 36 units completed, with 20 being occupied. Another 14 are under construction, with an additional 14 planned for future development. In 2023, Living Lands and Waters purchased the former visitor center, or Beacon Harbor, for office space. Freeman also highlighted the organization's Rivers Career Classroom Barge, Mississippi Institute for classes in the Quad Cities and up and down the Mississippi. New employees also joined the city in key positions, including a new city administrator, finance director, wastewater treatment plant director, and community development director. Freeman also said the city hopes to recruit a new fire marshal to undertake life safety inspections and a new crime analyst to focus on public safety efforts.
Going to a human interest story on the front page, tremendous role model. Former St. Ambrose athletes reflect on Bluder's Quad City start. This is written by Gretchen Teske. All eyes are on the Iowa Hawkeyes, but that's nothing new. For the last couple of years, the women's basketball team has dominated on the court, and TV ratings are catching up. While the world has its sights on Caitlin Clark, her coach, Lisa Bluder, is celebrating a milestone, too. This year marks Bluder's 40th year in coaching, a career that began in Davenport at St. Ambrose University. Her former athletes are still watching, and her accomplishments make them proud to still call her coach. I smile so much watching them on TV and knowing I played for her and seeing how she's grown and is this tremendous role model as a coach and as a person, said Kim Clark, a former Bees standout for Bluder. She lives according to her values, provides inspiration, and seems to be able to handle the tough situations. Bluder started her career in 1984 and led the Bees to a 18-13 record in her inaugural season and 20-12 the next. Within years, she turned the program around, with the Bees chalking up a total of just 11 losses from the start of the 1986 season until Bluder left in 1990. In between there, in 1988, Cindy Bourne transferred in and was ready to join a team chasing victory. A Chicago suburbs native, Bourne spent her first collegiate year playing for a different school closer to home. She quickly realized it was not a good fit and made the move to Iowa. That was a much better fit, and the rest is history, she said. That history, she said, started right away. Bourne went to a Catholic high school and felt right at home at St. Ambrose culturally and academically, she said. It felt like its own community, and the basketball program was well established under Bluder. During Bourne's first season with the Bees from 1988 to 1989, the team went 36-2 and qualified for the NAIA tournament. A Cedar Rapids native, Bluta graduated from Linmar High School in Marion before going on to earn a bachelor's degree in marketing from the University of Northern Iowa, where she was a three-year starter in basketball. After being hired as the women's basketball coach at St. Ambrose in 1984, she quickly proved her talent and was named NAIA District 15 Coach of the Year for the first time in 1986. During the 86-87 season, the Bees made their way to the NAIA National Tournament for the first time, finishing with a 29-3 record. The following year, from 87-88, the Bees reached the NAIA quarterfinals for the second straight year, falling to the eventual champion and finishing 32-5. In the fall of 88, Bourne transferred in and was ready to get to work. When it came time for her first practice with the team, there was no hesitation and no question of if she belonged. "We just jumped right in," she said. "They were very successful, so they had things dialed in." With the team rising the ranks toward success, Bluter immediately began working with Bourne to strengthen her skills. "I came in and coach pulled me aside and gave me some really good post moves," Bourne said. "We worked on those and they really became my bread and butter." The same year Bourne transferred in, so did Clark, a Muscatine native. But her story is a little different than most. When Clark was 14, her sister read an article in a magazine advertising team handball, a sport where two teams of seven compete against one another by passing a ball with their hands and throwing it into the goal of the opposing team. Her sister wrote in requesting an application, and Clark filled it out. She was accepted for tryouts in Colorado Springs and made the junior Olympic team her freshman year of high school. After a trip to what was then Yugoslavia, she was hooked. At 16 years old, she moved to New Jersey and joined the national team. Clark left high school to pursue handball full-time and went on to participate in the 88, 92, and 96 Olympics with Team USA. Despite her success on the handball court, Clark knew she wanted to pursue a college degree and she wanted to play basketball. But there was a catch. She had not played basketball since her freshman year of high school, and therefore had no stats to back up her skills. "I sent a letter to Coach Bluter saying I really wanted to play basketball in college, and she gave me this chance to prove myself," Clark said. "I am very, very thankful for her that she gave me an opportunity, because there was no film she could watch of me. She had to go on word of coaches in the area. Other than that, I just told her I was an athlete and I could play basketball." The gamble paid off. During the 89 season, Bluter coached St. Ambrose to a 36-2 record and a spot in the NAIA Final Four for the first time, losing a 90-89 game to Claflin, South Carolina, in the national semifinal. The next year, Bluter earned the NAIA Converse National Coach of the Year honors after a 34-1 season that ended in NAIA national semifinals and saw St. Ambrose ranked first nationally for the first time. Both Bourne and Clark took home awards, too. Bourne was named to the All-District team in 91 and was named to the National Catholic All-Tournament team in both 90 and 91. Clark played for the Bees in the 88-91 seasons and was named a District Player of the Year, an American Sports Federation All-American, and the MVP of the National Catholic Tournament, all in 91. The pair were not the only ones who found success, Clark noted. "The team still made it farther than any other in school history, and that tenacity is something she sees while watching the Hawkeyes today." "One thing with Coach Bluter's teams is there is great unity," Clark said. "Everybody feels valued at that competitive level." The success the Bees found in the late 80s truly reflects what is now happening with the Iowa women's team, Bourne said. Now living in California, she started watching the team at the end of last year. Her husband, a California native, is watching too. I've been trying to catch a lot of games this year, she said. It's very cool. Last year, when they were starting to go off, the Quad Cities went into the archives and started pulling out the videos. That was wild, but fun. With Iowa's success making national headlines in late 2023, SAU-TV, the broadcast studio at St. Ambrose, posted videos on YouTube showing interviews with Bluder from 1989. At that point, Bluder solidified herself as the all-time winningest coach at St. Ambrose, with a record of 130-34. Bluder, who was 27 years old at the time, told the TV station her young age was a benefit to her. While a lot of coaches tend to forget what players are going through during the school year or final weeks, she was able to relate. "It's not that long ago that I went through the same things they're going through," she said at the time. "I can remember the same things they're going through that I think a lot of coaches tend to forget their players are going through off the court." The segment wraps with footage of Bluder practicing with her team while a voiceover from Steve Tappa plays. He later worked as a sports writer for the Moline Dispatch from 89 to 2019. She hopes to be a Division I coach someday, but for right now, she is content being a busy bee, Tappa said. Bourne said coaching at a higher level is something she knew could happen for Bluder, with St. Ambrose acting as a stepping stone for her career. However, the coach she was then and the coach she watches on TV now are different. "She was new back then, so she was almost learning her way," Bourne said. "But we still went to the Final Four 2 years in a row. She was phenomenal." Clark reflected that sentiment, saying the drive and passion is what helped her team find success. "She expected a lot out of you. She was going to work very, very hard for you, so in turn you had to up your game. She was working her tail off for you, and she had that presence that you didn't want to let her down. She had that edge to her. She had the extra ingredients that it takes to get to a certain level, this high of a level." The time to elevate to a higher level came earlier than Clark expected or wanted. "I was heartbroken when she left my senior year and went to Drake," she said. In 1990, after a 169-36 record over six seasons, Bluder left St. Ambrose to become the women's basketball coach at Drake University in Des Moines. "The time was right for me to make a move," Bluder said at the time. "St. Ambrose is a tough place to leave because of the people, but professionally, it was a move that I felt good about." Bluder stayed at Drake for 10 years before taking the head coaching job at Iowa in 2000. The next year, the Hawkeyes took home the first Big Ten championship under Bluder's leadership, the second in program history after a victory over the University of Illinois in 1997. This weekend, the Hawkeyes will attempt to take home the fifth victory in school history and their third Big Ten championship in a row after taking down Indiana in 2022 and Ohio State last year. Clark, now living in Atlanta, will be watching, and not just because she almost shares a last name with the Hawkeyes' most famous player. Her eyes will be on Caitlin Clark just like everyone else. But she'll also be watching the coach that gave her a chance all those years ago. That ability and the strength to fight on despite the challenges is what sets not only the Hawkeyes apart, Clark said, but also sets Bluder apart as a coach. "That's what you see in her teams. They'll always have a smile. They're fighting tooth and nail, but every now and then they'll show the smile, the passion, the love. And that's why they're out there playing," she said. "It's a credit to her to have that atmosphere and environment to show that enthusiasm." The Hawkeyes play Friday night at 5:30 on the Big Ten Network and Fox Sports app. If all goes well, they'll play in the semifinals on Saturday following the 1 p.m. game and the championship Sunday at 11. Win or lose, Bluder has already won, in Clark's eyes. From her start at St. Ambrose to now accomplishing her dream, Bluder has made an impact on women's sports that reaches far outside the Iowa City limits. "It's crazy how much she has brought women's basketball and the enthusiasm to Iowa and nationwide with the Hawkeyes, Clark said. It's a very warm feeling to see her on top now.
Thanks, Rachel. Very interesting. And turn to an article here on the local page, Sustainability Shines. Zimmerman Honda adds solar array to Moline facility. This written by Gretchen Teske of the Quad City Times. Sunny days are not just good for selling cars at Zimmerman Honda in Moline. Now they will help power the entire building. The dealership has been around since 1952, originally opening in Moline. 10 years later, it moved to Rock Island, where it stayed for decades. In late 2011, owner Mark Zimmerman announced plans to move back to Moline to its current location at 7030 44th Avenue. At Thursday's ribbon-cutting ceremony, Zimmerman recounted the changes that have been made to the dealership in the last several years. Solar option, but there were obstacles. We started looking at this years ago and it didn't seem feasible, he said. We have been in business for 72 years, and except for building this building and moving to Moline 12 years ago, this is the largest investment we have ever had. Zimmerman said the return on investment would be quick, with the dealership expected to save about $27,226 on its electric bill in the first year. By year 25, that number is upward of $1 million in savings. In the long term, it will be a great thing, he said. Things are moving forward, moving ahead, and I couldn't be happier. During the first year of operation, the 282.9 kilowatt DC system will produce 398,017 kilowatt hours of electricity. Installed recently, the system supplies 98% of the annual electricity usage. Zimmerman Honda will have a carbon footprint reduction of 7,543.22 tons of CO2 over the lifetime of the system. This is equivalent to driving reduced by 829,754 gallons of gas, recycling 26,401 tons of waste instead of sending it to a landfill, 850,214,979 smartphones charged, 7,920,379 fewer pounds of coal burned, and planting 189,523 trees. The solar array consists of 690 panels on the roof of the dealership, said John Hutchcroft, a partner with Eagle Point Solar. It is believed to be the largest solar array in the Quad Cities area. Panels weigh about 40 pounds apiece and were installed over a few weeks, he said. They require no batteries and are built to sustain strong winds, hail, and storm damage. I once heard that you should plant a tree whose shade you will never enjoy, he said. That this is the same thing, building that legacy. The project in Moline started about a year ago when business manager Eric Waldman inquired with Dubuque-based Eagle Point Solar about adding LED lighting to the dealership. Solar came up, he said, and Zimmerman Honda decided to take a chance. The installation was completed in December 2023, and the grid went live in January. So far, so good, Waldman said, and the timing could not have been better. In about a month, the newest line of electric vehicles from Honda will make their way to Moline. Now the dealership can power electric cars with renewable energy. it made sense for us, and it's something I'm very grateful to have this project because it supports our community and our business. Eagle Point Solar was a fantastic partner throughout the whole process.
Expo highlights trades. This article is by Olivia Allen of The Times. The sound of tools, machines, and junior high students filled the Iowa Army National Guard in Davenport on Thursday. Roughly 220 junior high students from around the Quad Cities had a chance to seal drywall, build structural foundations, operate drills, and more at the 2024 Hands-On Trades Expo. Hosted by the Quad Cities Builders and Remodelers Association and its Student Trades Initiative, the event aimed to pique students' interest in the skilled trades before they sign up for high school classes. Students rotated through interactive hands-on stations at the expo, each led by local industry professionals, and performed small tasks or jobs focused on a different skill. Stations included plumbing, HVAC, drywall, framing, heavy equipment provided by the Iowa National Guard, electrical, roofing, and a walls foundation station led by NextGen ICF, featuring insulated concrete forms. Addison Mueller, a seventh grader at Sudlow Intermediate in Davenport, said Thursday was her first time using a drill. "We got to drill screws into actual walls," she said, before shifting to the NextGen station. "We built our ICF really high. I didn't actually think we were going to build walls and stuff today." Addison said the expo reinforced her interest in architecture, but she'd recommend it to her peers regardless of their interests. "It's just fun," she said. "It gives you a taste of everything they have in the skilled trades." While the expo is indeed fun, it also aims to foster a pipeline into the local workforce, a critical need, QCBR leaders say. "There's probably not one builder or remodeler that wouldn't take somebody right now," said Executive Officer Mona Pfeiffer. "They are hiring straight out of high school." She suspects that most QCBR member organizations are short-staffed, underlining the need for school-based exposure of the skilled trades. "With some students, you can tell it's just another field trip for them," Pfeiffer said of the expo. "But even if we get 25% signed up for the trades, it's great. If you become a plumber or an electrician, you can go anywhere to get a job. That is your profession, and no one can take that from you. It's pretty cool," she said, "and you know, there's not that college debt, and they can go straight into the workforce." I'm going to skip ahead a little bit in the article. For students who aren't interested in a trades career, Pfeiffer hopes they can gain helpful life and household skills at the expo. "It's so easy to switch an outlet out of your house so you're not paying someone $150. Even those little things will help them." At the expo, students were encouraged to ask station leaders questions about their careers, such as what a day in the life is like. "We have almost 260 QCBR members in the area, and station leaders are all volunteers from those businesses," Pfeiffer said. Steve Ingleby, founder of Ingleby Construction, was among those volunteers at the framing station. "I love it, just seeing the kids and their excitement when they actually see something get built. What I loved about framing was that every day you got to see your accomplishments. It's rewarding, and I think these kids saw that today just with all the different stations and what they can do in a short amount of time." As a Pleasant Valley High School graduate, Ingleby was happy to provide his opportunity for local students. "When I was in eighth grade, we didn't have stuff like this. I wish we would have, because I would have jumped all over it. It would have been a lot easier to set my future and know exactly what I wanted to do." Pfeiffer said the QCBR plans to start holding this expo in the fall, too, and will host a similar but more robust Build My Future expo for 9th through 12th graders next April. "The average age of a construction worker is 58 years old," she said. "So this new generation has got to get in." It's time now to turn to the obituaries in today's paper. We have several pending notices and then three obituaries. I'll read the pendings and the first one, Jim, if you'll take the other two. So services pending are for Norma Gaskins, age 96, who died on Monday, March 4th at her home in East Moline. Also pending for Cheryl Geiken, age 75, of Davenport, who died Thursday, March 7th at Clarissa Cook Hospice House. Also pending, Samuel D. Johnson, age 77, of Moline, who died Tuesday, March 5th at Unity Point Health, Trinity Medical Center, Rock Island. Betty L. Jones, age 91, of East Moline, died Thursday, March 7th. James Reinhardt, age 61, of Oskaloosa, Iowa, died Saturday, March 2nd. And Mitchell M. Woods, age 51, of Moline, died Tuesday, March 5th at his home. So services for those people are pending. Then the first obituary is for Monty D. Mitchell. Monty D. Mitchell, age 72, of Bettendorf, died March 6th, 2024, at Clarissa C. Cook Hospice House, Bettendorf, surrounded by family. Funeral services to celebrate Monty's life will be held at 10 a.m. Monday, March 11th, at the Halligan McCabe DeVries Funeral Home in Davenport. Burial will be in Oakdale Memorial Gardens in Davenport. Visitation will be from 2 until 5 p.m. Sunday, March 10th, at the funeral home. Memorials may be made to living lands and waters. Monty David Mitchell was born on May 15th, 1951, in Mason City, Iowa, a son of David and Arlene Mitchell. He graduated from Mason City High School in 1969 and Iowa State University with a degree in landscape architecture in 1973. He married Rhonda Wilson on June 21, 1974 in Mason City and later was united in marriage to Kathleen McGinn on July 7, 2017 in Davenport. Following graduation from ISU, Monty went in search of a job opportunity and settled in Davenport. He went to work at Platt's Nursery, then William Wainer and Associates, where he met David Hasenmiller. In 1981, Monty and David started Suburban Landscape Associates. They were awarded the Iowa Small Business of the Year in 1991 from the SBA and had the opportunity to be recognized in the Rose Garden at the White House by President George H.W. Bush. Monty was a registered landscape architect and served on the State of Iowa Board. Monty continued to operate Suburban until his retirement in 2023. Monty was a member of the QC Home Builders Association, LPYC, Davenport Country Club, and Crow Valley Golf Club. It was always 5 o'clock somewhere in Monty's eyes, and he was a regular fixture at the Stockade in the village of East Davenport. Monty was a lifelong Cyclone and Hawkeye fan and enjoyed visiting Florida, playing golf, and boating in his free time. He will be missed by all who knew and loved him. Those left to honor his memory are his wife, Kathleen, son, Tyler, spouse, Sarah Mitchell, all of Bettendorf, a stepson, Hunter Spreen of Davenport, grandchildren, Ava and David and Sean, siblings, Mark Mitchell, wife, Nancy of Kalamazoo, and Ann, spouse, Jim Finneman of Cedar Rapids, and many nieces and nephews. He was preceded in death by his stepson, David Spreen, in 2023. His granddog, Raleigh, his parents, and a nephew, Drake Finneman. May they rest in peace. Online condolences may be expressed by visiting Monty's obituary at hmdfuneralhome.com.
And we have Donald Anderson. On March 6th, Donald L. Anderson passed away in his home, in the home his parents built 71 years before. He was born October 5th, 1949. He was adopted by the Theodore Anderson and Elvina Sadie Anderson. Donald graduated from Bettendorf High School in 1968. He enlisted in the Army and served in the Vietnam War from September 1969 to July of 1971. He was a decorated bomb defusing specialist. He attended Scott Community College and took auto body classes. In May 1974, he got a job at the Davenport Public Works Department. In the waste barter department, he was there for 31 years, retiring at the age of 2005. He was married to Nancy Dower. She passed away in 1977. He later married Deborah Ayers. Then on July 13, 2001, he married Cindy Perry Smith. Donnie's pride and joy was his 1992 F-150 truck that was purchased for him by his dad, brand new. Donnie loved his pets, which included 3 tortoises, 3 water turtles, a black cat, and an iguana. Donnie is survived by his wife, Cindy, 2 daughters, Jennifer, spouse Mark Brandt of Fowlerville, Michigan, and Tammy Ayers of Davenport. Also 2 stepchildren. He is also survived by 7 grandchildren and 6 great-grandchildren. Per his request, he was cremated and there will be no services at this time. He will be buried at the Swedish Cemetery in Knoxville, Illinois. Cremation will take place at Trimble Crematory, Moline, Illinois, under the direction of Cremation Society of the Quad Cities, and condolences may be shared at cremationqc.com. Margaret Maggie Garrison, 84, a resident of Davenport, died on Tuesday, March 5th at her home. Funeral services will be held at 1 o'clock p.m. Saturday, March 9th at the McGinnis Chambers Funeral Home in Bettendorf. Visitation will be from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Saturday at the funeral home, and burial will be at Davenport Memorial Park. She was born in Centerville, Iowa on May 13, 1939, the oldest of 8 children to George and Catherine Cross Sellers. On March 15, 1958, she married Kenneth C. Garrison in Unionville, Iowa. He preceded her in death on December 11, 2008. Maggie was a devoted homemaker and was an accomplished wedding cake maker. Her grandchildren were the joy of her life, and she enjoyed reading and doing her daily crossword puzzle. For many years, she and her friends gathered on Wednesdays for coffee and pie at the Village Inn. Those left to honor her memory include her daughters, Cheryl, spouse Kenny, Burroughs of Lynn Center, Illinois, and Vicky, spouse John Wild, Garrison of Rock Island. Her son Hal, spouse Kenesha Garrison of Norman, Oklahoma. And then her grandchildren, Miranda Clower, Kimberly Ricketson, Rachel Clower, Kelsey Terrell, Katie Wild, and John Wild. Her great-grandson, Braden Ricketson. Her sisters, Jane Gilliland of Farmersburg, Iowa, and Ruth Riley of Bagley, Iowa. Her brother, Larry Sellers of Scranton, Iowa. Her brothers-in-law, Rick Nesson of Billings, Montana, and Alvin Clark of Yale, Iowa. And many nieces, nephews, and cousins. In addition to her husband, she was preceded in death by her sisters, Carol Nesson and Mary Clark, and her brothers, Lloyd Sellers and Robert Wayne Sellers. Condolences may be expressed to the family by viewing her obituary at www.mcginnischambers.com.
Next, we move to the opinion page of today's Quad City Times. The first piece is from the Virginian Pilot newspaper. It's under the category Another View. And the title is Lawsuit Could Change, Even End the NCAA. Could a lawsuit filed by the Attorneys General of Virginia and Tennessee further erode or even end the NCAA's regulatory role in college athletics? If so, it would be a victory for the students, whose sweat on the field and court earns the NCAA and its member schools billions each year. The NCAA's end seems closer than ever after a judge recently issued a preliminary injunction against the organization, halting its enforcement of rules that allow students to earn money based on their name, image, and likeness, also known as NIL. Colleges and universities benefit dramatically from the success of their student athletes, Virginia Attorney General Jason Miaris said. It's only fair that student athletes also get the full picture of how they may benefit from their choice of school as well. How dramatically do they benefit? According to revenue numbers from USA Today covering the 22-23 school year, the athletics programs at public universities in only two conferences, the SEC and the Big Ten, collected $2.17 billion and $2.04 billion in revenue, respectively. Some 22 schools topped $150 million in revenue. While there have always been haves and have-nots in college sports, the explosion of television revenue from football and men's basketball means schools, especially in major conferences, are raking in more money than ever. Yet, until recently, the athletes were compensated only through scholarships, and only a fraction of roughly 500,000 students who compete under the NCAA umbrella enjoyed even that. The NCAA prohibited athletes from trading in on their prowess and popularity, meaning a fan could buy a $100 replica of their favorite player's jersey, but the player wouldn't see a dime. That might make sense if collegiate athletics were truly an amateur endeavor, but with schools, conferences, bowl games, and everyone else cashing in, it's absurd that the kids on the field shouldn't share the benefits. That has changed as the NCAA lost several lawsuits challenging its control of player opportunities and behavior. The introduction of NIL enables athletes to sign sponsorship deals or earn, essentially, a salary for playing sports, though only a handful of budding superstars make a significant sum. The joint Tennessee-Virginia lawsuit takes aim at the enforcement of those rules and their application during recruitment. It argues that limiting NIL opportunities amounts to an unfair restriction of trade in violation of the federal Sherman Antitrust Act. The NCAA has lobbied Congress to extend the organization an antitrust exemption without success. The preliminary injunction issued Friday suspends the NCAA's power to enforce NIL rules while the case is decided. The NCAA wants to preserve a reality that no longer exists. There is no assurance that what follows will be markedly better, but it will represent a step forward if it puts the rights of student athletes first and fairly compensates them for their time and talent. Again, that piece is from the newspaper known as the Virginian Pilot.
Thanks, Rachel. And a second article from the opinion page. Data shows no link between mail ballots and illegal voting. This written by Stephen Rosenfeld. He's the editor and chief correspondent of Voting Booth, a project of the Independent Media Institute. It is an article of faith among those who do not believe Donald Trump lost in 2020 that mailing ballots to voters increases illegal voting, often called voter fraud. Before the machines were introduced, vote riggers needed a way to cheat, and it always involved generating loose ballots, read a recent post on a pro-Trump Telegram election education channel. It's possible, and therefore it happens, says a nearby post. It is understandable why disappointed Trump supporters are wary of mailed-out ballots. The COVID-19 pandemic led to an historic expansion of their use and a way to protect voters and election workers. By the time the 2020 election ended, 73 million Americans, 46% of all voters nationwide, had voted with a mailed-out ballot. That volume was nearly triple the voters who received a ballot by mail in 2018's general election. But articles of faith are not facts. As the 2024 presidential cycle revs up and Trump, the presumptive GOP nominee, keeps attacking elections, it is worth revisiting the most extensive national study by political scientists that looked at whether mailed-out ballots have any relation to voter fraud. In a word, their answer was no. That conclusion was based on comparing incidents of illegal voting during the two decades before the 2020 presidential election to the increasing use of mailed-out ballots during that time. If voting by mail creates more opportunities for fraud, those opportunities do not appear to have been realized in the data, George Mason University Assistant Professor Jonathan Arbach and Stephen Pearson, Director of Science Policy for the American Statistical Association, wrote in their 2021 analysis for ASA's journal Statistics and Public Policy. The statisticians are not saying voter fraud does not exist. They are showing, with state-by-state data from 2000 through 2019, that it is exceptionally rare. When illegal voting has occurred, their charts reveal, it usually involves no more than several dozen ballots. That volume is nowhere near the thousands of votes that would have been needed to alter the closest recent presidential election margins. It is important to emphasize how rare illegal voting is. Despite partisan rhetoric, in my book, Democracy Betrayed, which looks at anti-democratic efforts by both major parties in the 2016 election, I noted the extent to which some Republicans have overclaimed about illegal voting for years. That effort has been led by the right-wing Heritage Foundation, which has compiled and hyped a database of illegal voting across America. As of 2016, when Trump was elected president, Heritage's data set cited 492 cases and 733 convictions between 1984 and 2016. That is one case for every 2 million presidential voters. About 980 million presidential votes were cast. If you count by convictions, with some people pleading to more than one charge, that total is still less than 1 in a million voters. In other words, illegal voting is not rampant. Nonetheless, the statisticians used Heritage's database and another data set compiled by Arizona State University's Walter Cronkite School of Journalism. The researchers probed to see if illegal voting was more prevalent in the states that mailed ballots to voters by comparing the rates of voter fraud in states that did and did not mail ballots. They also looked to see if instances of voter fraud grew after a state began mailing ballots to voters. They found no relation between mailing ballots and illegal voting. What the researchers did find, however, was that illegal voting was most prevalent in local votes, in local races, where a small number of voters could alter the outcome. So, in the few instances where illegal voting happened, it was not in a presidential election. A large amount of fraud comes from primaries and state and local elections, they wrote. These elections typically have lower turnout. Again, the researchers are not saying that voter fraud is non-existent, but they are saying that after examining 20 years of state-by-state data, we find no evidence to suggest that voting by mail increases the risk of voter fraud overall. That conclusion is worth remembering as accusations surrounding mailed out ballots continue in 2024. Of course, other academic studies assess the impact that mailing ballots has on voter turnout. States that mail ballots have some of the highest voter participation rates, which factually benefits both parties. But 2020 presidential election deniers don't believe that assessment either.
There is a third short editorial on today's opinion page that I'm going to read. It's by columnist Frama Harrop, who's a syndicated columnist. "Yes, You Can Haul Your Butt to an Early Meeting" is the title of it. The Wall Street Journal ran a curious piece titled, "Is It Ever Okay to Have an 8 a.m. Meeting?" It contained two dubious assumptions: that 8 a.m. is very early in the morning, and, secondly, employees have a right to rebel against a company policy that interferes with drop-off time for kids at school, or forces them to alter their workout schedules. One can sympathize with a parent's desire for predictable schedules, but if they can't be flexible enough to occasionally show up at work an hour early, they may need a different employer. Many global businesses, particularly in finance, may need everyone together at a time when they can confer with colleagues in other time zones. As the article notes, early morning work hours are a hallmark of the finance and healthcare industries, as well as education, and a standby of high-powered executives. But what made 8 a.m. such an outrageously early hour? To a lot of working Americans, 8 a.m. is practically lunchtime. Firefighters, police, nurses, and emergency room doctors work the entire night. Some are lucky if they get home by 8 a.m. In rural America, the cows have already been milked by 6 a.m. About 16% of full-time employees work on alternative shifts, according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. Meanwhile, a gust of entitlement blows from some of these squawks about early meetings. Quote, "If I have to push myself to an 8 o'clock meeting," 36-year-old Jake Rudy says, "I really had better have a good reason for being there." Keeping his job could be a good reason. "If an early meeting has to happen," Lorna Hagen said, "managers should notify workers well in advance." Fair enough, when possible. But speaking in Gen Z, she added, "Companies have to be very intentional about what conditions they set." I once had an editing job that started at 6 a.m. As part of my interview, the boss sternly asked me, "You are going to be here at 6 a.m., right?" I answered, "Yes, that's the job," and was hired. I've since developed enormous respect for those who rise in the early hours to serve the 9-to-5ers. During a stay in Kirkland, Washington, I recall visiting the only place that served coffee at 6 a.m. It was a downtown Starbucks where two young women served pre-dawn lattes with unforgettable cheer. They had opened the place at 5:30. As for my 6 a.m. editing job, true, I didn't like having to haul out of bed at 4:30 a.m. to dress and catch a downtown bus to the office, but navigating pre-dawn Manhattan now remains one of my most fabulous dreamscapes. Because of the early hour, buses were few, so I'd catch the same one every day. I got to know the bus driver. When did he get up? And also the janitors on their way to opening downtown office buildings. We formed something of a club. The bus passed through Times Square at around 5:45 a.m., a strange, bewitching hour, where late night met early morning. You could look up at the second floors and see revelers still dancing under disco balls. On street level, meanwhile, a small army of trucks was bringing danishes to the city's coffee shops, preparing to open for the morning commuters. Workers can rightly fight off demands to answer non-urgent emails after dinner. But the boundaries they draw have to be consonant with the terms of employment. If someone routinely working 9 to 5 is expected to show up at 8 a.m. for a special meeting, well, that's the job. You just have to take it, or as the song goes, shove it. That from Frama Harrop. And that brings us to the end of the Quad City Times for today. My name is Rachel Mithelman, and my partner at the microphone has been Jim Hoffman. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. And thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.